It's the NPR News Update. I'm Phil Picardi with Minnesota's news on your schedule on this Tuesday, September 23rd. Coming up on the podcast, credit card account alerts. The governor takes steps to keep child abuse cases from slipping through the cracks. And what is restorative justice? First, Twin Cities-based Medtronic is running into increasing regulatory opposition to its planned merger with Ireland-based Covidien. Martin Moylan has more.
The U.S. Treasury Department is taking steps aimed at thwarting so-called tax inversion deals like the one involving Medtronic and Covidien. The typical transaction involves a U.S. company buying a firm based in a foreign tax haven and then moving the combined company's legal headquarters there for tax purposes. The Obama administration has branded such transactions as unpatriotic tax dodges and promised to fight them. Treasury Secretary Jacob Lew said the agency's new actions will reduce the economic benefit of inversions. The complex new restrictions apply to pending mergers, including the marriage of Medtronic and Covidien. Medtronic has argued that the transaction will enable it to put billions of dollars in foreign earnings to work in the U.S. The company said it is assessing the possible impact of Treasury's actions.
Martin Moylan is an NPR News business reporter. He also tells us that Minnesotans' days of escaping state sales taxes on orders from Amazon.com are coming to an end.
Starting October 1st, the online retailer says it will begin collecting sales taxes from Minnesota residents. Online-only retailers don't have to collect state sales taxes if they do not have a physical location in a state. But Amazon says it is considering various opportunities to expand in Minnesota. The retailer has been collecting sales taxes in a growing number of states as it establishes warehouse or other operations in them to speed the delivery of goods. The state revenue department has estimated Minnesota loses $400 million a year in uncollected sales taxes for online catalog and other purchases made by state residents. Richfield-based Best Buy has long complained that the sales tax exemption for online merchants gives them an unfair price advantage. Martin Moylan, Minnesota Public Radio News.
The family of a man killed in the Accent signage shooting in 2012 has reached a settlement with the company. Matt Sepik reports.
Jacob Beneke was one of six people Accent signage worker Andrew Engeldinger shot and killed at the Minneapolis business nearly 2 years ago. Minnesota's deadliest workplace shooting ended with Engeldinger's suicide. Beneke's family sued Engeldinger's estate and Accent signage. They claimed the company should have known Engeldinger was a possible danger. Last summer, a judge rejected claims against the estate but allowed those against the company to move forward. Plaintiff's attorney Phil Williams says the case was resolved by mutual agreement but would not offer any other details. In a statement, Accent Signage confirms the settlement, but also declined further comment. Beneke was 34 years old and left a wife and young son. Matt Sepik, Minnesota Public Radio News.
The Ivy Awards for Theater in the Twin Cities were announced last night. Here's arts reporter Marianne Combs.
For the first time in the Ivy's 10-year history, two people took home the Lifetime Achievement Award. The split is fitting since the winners are theater duo Michael Robbins and Bonnie Morris. They co-run the Illusion Theater, which has developed more than 350 new plays since Robbins founded the company in 1974. Actress Sally Wingert was recognized for an exceptional year of performances, and the cast of Jungle Theater's Driving Miss Daisy won an award for ensemble performance. Tyler Michaels, a graduate of Minnesota State University Moorhead's Theater Arts Program, won the Emerging Artist Award. Marianne Combs, Minnesota Public Radio News.
Governor Mark Dayton has announced several steps he says will improve the state's child protection system. The action comes after the Star Tribune reported that county workers did not follow up on abuse complaints about a Pope County boy who was later murdered by his stepmother. It also comes just weeks after Vikings football player Adrian Peterson was indicted on charges of abusing his son. Tom Scheck reports.
Governor Dayton started his news conference by referencing Eric Dean, the 4-year-old Starbuck boy who was abused by his stepmother. Despite 15 complaints from Dean's daycare providers and others, his case was only investigated once. Dean's stepmother is in prison for his murder.
The picture of 4-year-old Eric Dean smiling at the camera, despite a visible wound on his face, will haunt me for a long time.
Dean's case and the story behind it prompted questions from policy leaders, legislators, and others. They include how clear signs of abuse can be ignored or overlooked by county employees whose job is to stop abuse. Dayton's executive order requires the Department of Human Services to conduct monthly random screenings of decisions made by county child protection workers. Human Services Commissioner Lucinda Jessen says the screenings are aimed at ensuring county workers are doing their jobs.
If we come across a screening decision that's not following state protocols, we will immediately call the Human Service Director and have it make sure appropriate action is taken in that case.
Dayton's executive order also creates a joint county-state team of child protection experts to advise county workers. Minnesota is one of 12 states that allows counties to administer human services programs such as child protection. The state oversees that work. Dayton also announced a task force to review the state's child protection system to determine whether more changes are needed. Ramsey County Commissioner Tony Carter, who will co-chair the task force with Jessen, said counties welcomed the additional oversight. She said the task force will also consider whether more funding is needed to help counties investigate child protection complaints.
This is an opportunity for us together to scrutinize exactly what resources may be missing and needed within counties so that we can work together as partners across these systems to make certain our children are safe.
The state cut $36 million in child services over the past 10 years, and some think more money and oversight are needed. Richard Gehrman is the executive director of Safe Passage for Children of Minnesota, a group that advocates for child protection and foster care. Gehrman praised the governor for his action, but said more needs to be done. He said only 29% of calls of maltreatment in Minnesota are investigated, compared to 62% nationally. Gehrman worries situations like Eric Dean's may be more common than most people think.
We think that's the way the system is working. There's many, small reports, anecdotal reports that reinforce that. But what I like about where the governor and the commissioner are going is that this will begin to get some information that you can see on a regular basis without doing a special study or without just talking to a lot of people. And that'll help us see where there's a need for improvements in the system.
Dayton says the task force will be named next month and will present its findings to Dayton and lawmakers by the end of the year. Tom Scheck, Minnesota Public Radio News at the Capitol.
City leaders from Minneapolis hosted a youth summit on restorative justice yesterday. Generally speaking, restorative justice prefers a rehab rather than punitive approach to crime and punishment. Guests, including Minneapolis Police Chief Janae Harto and Parks and Recreation Board, City Council, and school board members participated in that event, which included a panel familiar with both the juvenile justice and restorative justice systems. City Council member Andrew Johnson hosted the event, and he talked with Tom Cran last night.
So perhaps first let's start with a quick explanation or definition, as you see it, of restorative justice. What exactly is it?
Crime, basically, it hurts everyone, the victim, the offenders, and the community. And what restorative justice does is it brings the community and the victim and the offender together and really offers an opportunity to make up for the wrong that occurred.
Doesn't that happen already sometimes?
Well, we do have restorative justice programs within our city, and there is some funding available for them. But what we see is a real opportunity, especially as city leaders are talking about One Minneapolis and how important it is to solve disparities and really result in increased racial equity. We see a huge opportunity around restorative justice.
So give me a little more specifically, how would using restorative justice and incorporating into criminal justice system help with some of those things you mentioned, such as racial disparities?
In our state, for instance, you are four times higher for risk of expulsion or suspension if you are a black student versus a white student. And nationally, if you are a black male, there's a 1 in 3 chance that you'll end up in prison at some point. And when folks have records and they end up in the criminal justice system, oftentimes they are more likely to repeat. They are going to have trouble in many cases getting jobs. it really has a huge, tremendous impact on their lives. And we see both the impact on their lives and the difficulty of essentially getting back on track, and also we see the disparities in this regard, in that we have a system which, through both institutionalized racism and as well the criminal justice system, we're ultimately not getting what we want, which is to have good, productive members of society that are not reoffending and not just getting back out there, and are instead making amends for what they did wrong and are able to contribute.
So what is the next practical step here? Because I imagine, as you describe this, there is some, bound to be some resistance to this in certain parts of the community, right?
The goal today was to bring the city leadership together, to bring law enforcement together with youth, with restorative justice programs and providers, and really build buy-in and build common ground and support for moving forward policy changes.
Practically, then, what is the next step in Minneapolis?
So what we're going to do is take these conversations from today, and we're going to come forward with some policy recommendations. We're going to take our notes back, go over all of this, analyze it, come up with some solid recommendations. But as well, you know, we're going through our budget conversations right now. Our city attorney's office spends over $7.6 million prosecuting criminals, and our police department is going to cost us almost $150 million this year. And so we're going to have these conversations about our budget priorities, and I think that part of that needs to be investing in getting people back on the right track once they go off of it, so that they're not turning into career criminals and going on to reoffend down the line, which is a cost that we all pay for.
Councilmember Andrew Johnson of the Minneapolis City Council, thank you very much for your time and perspective on restorative justice.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me, Tom.
Minneapolis City Councilmember Andrew Johnson and Tom Cran on All Things Considered. From time to time, we'd like to check in with NPR News digital media editor Michael Olson. Michael, let's start with today's question on our sites. And Michael Olson, that feature has produced a lot of discussion, I guess, in the last 24 hours or so about a couple of different items now. But yesterday you were talking about e-cigarettes.
Right. The e-cigarette debate is pretty heated and actually very well thought out. You know, you don't always get to see that in an online exchange, but there's some very thoughtful comments about the proposal that Minneapolis is considering to treat e-cigarettes just as any other cigarette, which would have them be banned from bars and restaurants.
And what kinds of discussion are we looking at? You say well thought out from both sides, I'm guessing.
Yeah, I really feel that there are compelling arguments on both sides. For the folks that are that would like to see them treated the same, they're saying, hey, look, this is a health issue just like any other issue. We don't know what's in the liquid concoction for the cigarettes. On the flip side, people that are in support of allowing e-cigarettes in bars and restaurants say, well, we don't know, but there also hasn't been proven harm associated with this. It's, you know, when tobacco was banned, when smoking tobacco was banned, it was based in large part on secondhand smoke. And there's no documented case on this in terms of what the harm would be to an individual sitting next to somebody that would be vaping.
Hmm. And that leads us into today's question, which sort of, I guess, dovetails off of that a little bit anyway.
Yeah, absolutely. We picked up on Marty Moylan's story about Amazon starting to charge for, or that in about a week they'll be charging sales tax, which for Minnesotans, which hasn't been the case. And so we're wondering how that's changing people's shopping behavior. This was a discussion that we had during the last legislative session. The state of Minnesota estimates that it's roughly $400 million right. a year
mm-hmm.
that
yeah.
that Minnesota's missing out on because of tax-free online shopping.
And so the question then is, should the Minnesotans pay taxes on those items?
Well, and yes, essentially that's the gist, just asking people if they're less likely to shop online if they have to pay taxes. So we're taking a look there. And actually, one of our stellar interns on the digital desk is pulling together an FAQ around this. We're trying to figure out, you know, Amazon wouldn't comment what type of operation they would have here. So we're taking a look at, you know, the way that they've been bringing in warehouses and other doing other real estate purchases. So we'll see what we turn up with that.
And that has been one of the stipulations in the law, that you don't have to collect state sales taxes if you don't have a physical building or entity in that state. But Amazon now says they do want to have some physical presence in Minnesota.
Absolutely. And it's there's a lot of speculation about what that might be. Is it just a warehouse? But Amazon is diversifying, as many of these technology-based companies are. So it's kind of a mystery on what exactly they would have planned here. They also, we saw in our initial reporting on this, that, that the same steps are being made in Maryland right now, too.
And where can the podcast listeners find today's question?
You can find it on the homepage at nprnews.org.
All right, Michael, thank you very much.
Thanks.
Michael Olson is a digital editor for nprnews.org. His work on Twitter and Facebook as well. With cyber crooks grabbing credit and debit card numbers by the tens of millions, there's growing interest in a simple fraud alert system for consumers. No one knows better than a cardholder if a purchase is legit or not. That's why many consumers now get virtually instantaneous account alerts sent to their mobile phones. We go back to a very busy Marty Moylan.
Every time there's a transaction on his Wells Fargo debit card, Richard Davies Stoku of Minneapolis gets a text message on his mobile phone, whether he's here at the Mall of America or anywhere else.
If I were to go into like Chico's, make a transaction, it'll immediately pop up on my phone.
And if some thief uses his card or account number to buy something?
Anyone does anything on my card, it'll tell me immediately. And then it shows you exactly what the transaction is. If someone's in Old Navy using my card right now, it would actually alert me, let me know that you spent $29.99 at Old Navy.
The alerts can arrive in a matter of seconds. Here at the Lund's grocery store in downtown St. Paul, I'm buying a few things with a credit card.
$5.55.
I swipe my card, the cashier bags my items, hands me my receipt, and before I'm out the door, I get a text message on my phone reporting the transaction. Given a heads-up alert, you might have a shot at scuttling an unauthorized purchase. Generally, cardholders have to choose to get such missives. Banks are wary of sending uninvited messages, in part because that can rack up charges on someone's mobile bill. That's kept a lid on adoption. The financial industry consulting firm Javelin Strategy and Research estimates that about a quarter of bank customers receive at least one alert a month. But with the theft of account information and card fraud so much in the news these days, consumers are showing more interest in getting a heads up about anyone messing with their money. Al Pasquale is a fraud and security analyst with Javelin.
In 2013, we witnessed a record number of consumers becoming victims of existing card fraud. Just short of 5% had either their existing credit card account or their existing debit card account misused. We think a lot of that is actually being driven by data breaches.
Javelin estimates fraud on consumer cards cost $11 billion in 2013, with the average fraud amounting to about $1,400. Cardholders spent an average of 9 hours to resolve the mischief done by crooks. Pasquale says the value to both consumers and banks is likely to fuel adoption of alerts.
It saves the financial institutions money. They no longer have to have someone calling me, asking me whether or not I committed a transaction. It saves me grief, potentially, maybe maintain the relationship, too. If I'm a fraud victim and my bank doesn't tell me, then I might take issue with that.
Most banks and credit unions offer alerts free of charge. Those from the biggest banks tend to be fast and sophisticated, and they work.
Who's better to know that the transaction's fraudulent than the consumer themselves?
Stephanie Erickson is Visa's Vice President of Risk Products. Visa provides the technology behind 140 banks' alerts. Erickson says the payment card industry is very adept at spotting and stopping fraud, limiting it to 6 cents for every $100 of transactions. Alerts augment those efforts, but banks haven't been saying by how much.
The added benefit of giving the consumer control does help prevent some additional fraud and also gives the consumer a greater peace of mind.
Some companies' messages are far from immediate. Alerts for Target's Visa cards, for instance, take at least a day to go out after a transaction takes place. The retailer says it's working to speed up notifications. U.S. Bank says its alerts go out within seconds of a transaction. The bank touts the option in its marketing. Christine Hobro is U.S. Bank's regional market manager for the Twin Cities.
We've had customers say to us, my friend got an alert, I want that too. So they are a draw. We all care about our money. We work hard for it. And this helps. This really creates a partnership with the bank.
With cyber theft on the rise, those partnerships are likely to continue growing in the future. Martin Moylan, Minnesota Public Radio News.
That's the NPR News Update for Tuesday, September 23. I'm Phil Picardi. News on the 24th, right back here tomorrow.